Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 171 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. This week's episode is sponsored by Movement Watches. We get it. Holiday shopping can be tough, but thanks to Movement Watches, all that gift-giving anxiety can disappear with the press of a button. These watches make the perfect purchase for just about anyone in your life, guy or girl. And remember, they start at only $95.
They have a classic design. I love mine, and I think your person that you got yours for likes his, right?
He does. We had to remove a couple of watches from
them. Oh, was it too big?
It was too big. It was surprisingly. He's got very large wrists, and we had to actually remove.
He's a tall guy.
We had to remove two of the links, and we couldn't figure out how to do it. And I sent an email through their website saying, "Help! Is there a special tool we need?" They sent me a video, like within half an hour. I had a video showing us how to do it, and they popped right off super easy. So they have excellent customer service over at Movement Watches.
So their customer service, their quality construction, you can understand why they sold over 500,000 watches in over 160 countries. I mean, come on.
So you can get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to mvmtwatches.com/Outlander.
As I said before, this watch has a really clean design. I have been getting compliments ever since I put it on. Whenever I wear it, wherever I wear it, people always notice.
So now is the time to step up your watch game.
Go to mvmtwatches.com/Outlander.
Join the movement.
So today I can't really lie. Today I think we have a very special guest. I mean, all of our guests are special, but today we have someone it would be very fair to say, who is quite in the know.
She's doing the work. I feel like she's speaking, she's bringing us something new and something I think we'll all find a little bit interesting. So I'm excited.
So am I. So, dear listeners, we have today one Dr. Christine McKenzie, who graduated from the University of Aberdeen with an MA honors in 2001 and with her PhD in 2008. Now, Dr. McKenzie has held teaching posts at the University of Dundee, Open University, and the University of Aberdeen, and she is a fellow of the Higher Education Academy. Dr. McKenzie's research interests include the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, 1638 to 1651, the English Commonwealth and Protectorate, 1649 to 1660, print culture in Britain and Ireland during the 17th century, and I have a question about that, Jacobitism, and Scotland's relationship with the wider world. And her next project will focus on the impact of the Jacobite Wars in British and Irish society. So it is a huge Outlander podcast welcome to Dr. Christine McKenzie. Dr. McKenzie, thank you so much. It is a pleasure to have you here with us.
It's a pleasure to be invited.
So before we get started with some questions, either confirm something or tell me how wrong I am. When I read that some of your interests are print culture in Britain and Ireland during the 17th century, obviously the story of Outlander starts in the 18th century, or I should say, starts in the 1940s, but the story we all love is in the 18th century. And of course, now I'm going to leave a small space here for a potential spoiler warning. Okay, listeners, if you haven't gotten past Voyager, this is your warning here. Do, 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 do. Okay, that's enough. So, would there be any connection when you mention print culture? Does that have to do with the printing press?
Yeah, it has to do with printing press, books, and the book trade in the 17th and 18th centuries.
Okay, so there is another Outlander link there as well, because Alexander Malcolm, A. Malcolm, printer, that is a trade that Jamie learns and takes with him to the New World, and how he gets people into trouble, but it also, you know, helps him survive part of that time. So that's very interesting. We may have to have you back to discuss that. Okay, so Dr. McKenzie, what is your connection and interest in Outlander and the Jacobites?
As you already know, I'm a lecturer in history at University of Aberdeen, and I actually teach a course on the Jacobites, and Outlander is actually on our reading list.
That's fascinating. I've heard that other, maybe like in an, I don't know, in an American university somewhere, I believe I've heard Outlander has been on lists before, or put on lists of students who kind of maybe upper degree or upper level students who are kind of putting together their own, kind of making their own syllabus as maybe a senior project or something. And they bring it in to literature and to research. But I have heard of Outlander being used in the university setting. But this is fascinating that it's actually part of the reading list. Obviously, you have an interest in things that are tangential to Outlander. What was how hard was it to get it added to the reading list?
It wasn't that hard at all, in the sense that obviously I make up the reading list, but I actually had to buy a copy for the library because I wasn't too sure whether I would have to put it formally through the channels to buy it through the department. So I wasn't too sure how they would look upon that. But so I bought a copy for myself, but also for my students, and I put it in the library, and it caused a bit of consternation, let's say. Rumour went round the library of, oh, look what Dr. McKenzie's just, you know, submitted in the library. And that's when I found out that there are some massive Outlander fans in our university library as well. Because they were all overjoyed that there was a copy going into the library. So it was really interesting, you know. So it's actually in heavy demand in our library, which, as the name suggests, are books that are heavily in demand. So it's actually in our heavy demand section. I thought it'd be better to put it in there, just in case there was a bloodbath amongst the students trying to read it, because it is very, very popular amongst our students. They all know about Outlander, they all talk about Outlander, they love it. So why not? I mean, it fosters their interest, it keeps their interest growing. And to be honest, I have to owe Diana a debt of gratitude, because it has encouraged people to take my course on Jacobitism, and I owe her a great debt, and she's stimulated masses of interest in the Jacobite movement in Scottish history. So I owe her a great debt of gratitude for stimulating interest in the Jacobites. So it's great.
Do you ever have any students maybe who are not Outlander fans who get into your class and they start reading this book and they're like, why am I reading this?
Well, we do actually have students who, some of the students obviously already know what Outlander is, but others get to hear about it in class. So then they're on to something called Amazon Prime, which is where we watch it in the UK. We don't have it on TV like you do in the US. We get it through Amazon Prime. So they're all now watching it on Amazon Prime, and they'll go, well, I have to go and watch it now because they've heard so much about it. So they really do get enthusiastic about it and all the rest of it. So it does generate a lot of interest. So it's fantastic.
So I think you kind of answered this question a little bit as far as the interests of other students. They're either already interested in it, or they maybe become interested once they are in your class and see that it's part of the reading list. But in what context, how do you introduce or discuss Outlander in your classes?
Well, what we do is, it's really the introduction, the first seminar. We look at literary Jacobitism. So we look at Sir Walter Scott's Waverley, which is sort of the beginning of the sort of romanticisation of the Jacobites in novels. Then we go on to Robert Louis Stevenson's Kidnapped, which are both very famous works linked with the Jacobites in literature. And then at the end we discuss Outlander, because we also like to discuss how we currently view the Jacobites, how the Jacobites are currently viewed amongst people at large and academics. So we do discuss Outlander in class, and we sort of ask the question, how is J.B. Fraser portrayed? What's he like as a Jacobite? And they often say heroic. All the girls say he's very handsome. He's a fantastic person. But then, of course, we also ask the question about Black Jack Randall. How do you view him and the impact that has on our view of the Hanoverians, which was the other side of the Jacobite rebellion? And they give their opinion on Black Jack Randall, which, as you can imagine, is not so complimentary. But we have good fun. We have good fun with it, and it just breaks the ice. It makes them more comfortable in class, and of course, it's something that they can relate to. It's something that's fun, and it just gets the class off to a good start. But even towards the end of the class, we do a seminar on the Duke of Cumberland, who is, your listeners may or may not be aware, but he's a sort of, he was known as Butcher Cumberland because of the severity he came down on the Highlanders after Culloden. And he has a very dark reputation. But recently, believe it or not, historians have begun to reassess this reputation of Cumberland. And how we open up this discussion is that we look at Black Jack Randall as a character, and in essence a caricature of the Duke of Cumberland, and discuss how this image of, you know, the Butcher Cumberland has predominated, has survived. So Black Jack Randall towards the end of the course becomes something that we do discuss in terms of, you know, its relationship with Jacobite history. So it does... Outlander certainly has its place in the course.
So you teach at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland, which was founded in 1495, and being the northerlymost university in Britain at the time, it must have seen the impact of the 1745 Jacobite Rebellion at first hand. So what was the university's relationship with the 45?
Well, it during the 45, it stayed relatively quiet, and there are reasons for this. There was another Jacobite rebellion in 1715, and a lot of students in the two colleges, the University of Aberdeen at the time was made up of two colleges, one called King's College and the other one called Marshall College. And in the 1715, a few number of students got involved in the 1715 rising, so much so that after the rising failed, there was this disciplinary committee for all the naughty students who had taken part. So actually what happened was that when the 45 came along, all the students didn't dare join the rising. They stayed quiet in itself. And indeed, we have a James Gatt, who at the time of the 1715, he was a student and graduate at the university. He took part in the 1715 rising. But by the time we get to the 45, he's actually writing poetry for the Hanoverians, which shows you, you know, the impact of 1715 and the fact that that has an impact when we get to the 45, that the students won't rise. However, Aberdeen itself during the 45 is quite an interesting story, because the town itself is the third largest city in Scotland today. It's quite a big town in the northeast of Scotland, and it was quite a prominent town back in the 45. And it was one of the main ports on the east coast of Scotland. So it was strategically very important for the Hanoverians and for the Jacobites. And the year before the rebellion took off in 1744, the city had actually been put in a posture of defence by the Hanoverians. And the commander, Sir John Cope, said to the city that they had to surrender all their weapons to the Hanoverians. So any arms that the city had, they had to pass over to the Hanoverians. And he demanded all the town's weapons because he said if these were ever taken by the Jacobites, and he quotes, the town would lay themselves obnoxious to the government and be made answerable for such conduct. Now, of course, being issued with that threat, unsurprisingly, Aberdeen sort of went, oh, here's all our weapons, our arms, our cannons, etc. No, you have them. So the Hanoverians were quite aware of the prominence of Aberdeen to the Jacobite cause. So there was a lockdown the year before just to make sure the Jacobites didn't infiltrate the town. However, Cope did leave the town, and when he did, and this is during the 45, the Jacobite Sir John Hamilton appeared in the streets with horse and foot. So obviously the Jacobites saw their opportunity. And some sympathisers joined with Sir John Hamilton, and they forced the Lord Provost. Now, the Lord Provost is the equivalent of your mayor of a city. So he's quite a prominent man. He's he's, you know, the top man in the city council. He's the one who effectively runs the city. And he'd refused to toast the old pretender James in front of Sir John Hamilton. And Sir John Hamilton became very, very angry, to the point where he forced the Lord Provost down in his chair and tried to force this toast, this drink, down the Lord Provost's throat. And to the point where he became frustrated with the Lord Provost, and he threw the drink down the Lord Provost's chest, because obviously the Lord Provost wasn't going to take the drink. It's quite an infamous episode, but it shows that the Jacobites tried to take towns, and part of that process was to get the Lord Provosts in each town to drink to the health of the old pretender. And of course, in Aberdeen's case, the Lord Provost refuses, and the Jacobite Sir John Hamilton throws the wine goblet at the Lord Provost's chest. And for a short time, the city council was taken over by Charles Edward Stuart's appointed Lord Lieutenant of Aberdeen, Lord Lewis Gordon. So it had a temporary government. It was occupied by the Jacobites for a very short period of time. And it was run by somebody called Lord Lewis Gordon. But Aberdeen never heard the sound of gunfire. There were never any major battles or anything like that. And the precariousness of Jacobitism within the city. And bear in mind, of course, I said that the university and the colleges didn't rise, is because boys in the street actually cheered for King George. They cheered for the other side in front of the Jacobites who were then in the city, which kind of, I suppose, gives the impression that, I guess, you know, Jacobitism wasn't that popular if you've got young boys cheering for King George. But the most sort of significant element of Aberdeen, and I suppose the most infamous part of the story for Outlander fans, probably being all pro-Jacobite as you are, is that the Duke of Cumberland, the infamous Duke of Cumberland, stayed in Aberdeen for 6 weeks before he went up to Culloden. And he actually reinforced his army in the city, he gave them supplies, before he went marching up to Nairn and then on to Culloden. So he was making sure that he was ready to take on the army of Bonnie Prince Charlie before he went to Culloden. So it's so Aberdeen does have connections with the Risings, does have connections with the cause, and it is really quite an interesting story, really.
So even today, Aberdeen has connections with the Jacobites and the Jacobite cause. The University Archive has one of the most internationally renowned collections of Jacobite material found anywhere in Europe. Can you tell us more about this?
In our university archives, we have several collections which are of interest to Jacobite scholars. Most importantly, the McBean collection, which was donated to the university by New York businessman William M. McBean. And it is a resource of international importance. There are around about 3,500 books and 1,000 pamphlets on the Jacobite Risings. And some of these are held nowhere else in the UK, and some of them are completely unique. You won't find any of these anywhere else on the planet but in Aberdeen. And it's a massive collection of Jacobite material. And as a result, of course, with many of these things being unique, it is of international importance. There are also minutes of King's College. There are also minutes of the King's College Disciplinary Committee, of all those students that went running off to the 1715 rebellion, which would be quite interesting. There's also various estate papers of prominent families in the area, or families that got caught up in the Rising, including members of the Fraser clan, believe it or not, and also letters written by Charles Edward Stuart. So. It is a major collection, and it's very, very important. It's one of the most concentrated collections of Jacobite material anywhere in Europe, and so it's great.
So one of the most recent acquisitions within the university's special collections is the Diary of Alexander Smith. Now, why is this so significant and interesting?
The Journal of Alexander Smith is a journal which talks about his life. He's towards the end of his life and reflecting on what has happened during his life and key events. And this includes the Jacobite rebellions, one in 1715 and one in 1745. And the reason why this is interesting is because it shows us what impact the Jacobite risings had on ordinary people. And a square right was effective winner. It was somebody who worked with wood, who did carving, who did joinery. But it's also interesting to note the economic impact that the Jacobite risings had on somebody like him. In fact, he lived in a town called Fraserburgh, which is in the northeast of Scotland, on the coast. And as you can gather by the name, it's named after the clan Fraser. So this is a man who has significant links with the Fraser clan and the Fraser family, and he lives in Fraserburgh. But it's just very, very interesting to see what happens to him during the rebellion, because he is a bystander to events. He doesn't take part in it, but yet both risings of 1715 and 1745 have a major, major impact on his life.
Who was Alexander Smith? Could you tell us something about his background and where he lived?
He was born on the 2nd of June, 1696, in Fraserburgh. To George Smith, a merchant, and Isabel Bizet, who came from a family with small holdings in a place called Rattray, which wasn't far from Fraserburgh. His father was buried in debt, so Alexander Smith knew he had no inheritance would come his way. So he decided to get a trade. But before he did this, he actually went to school, and his father had taught him to read. But he didn't like school. So his schooling wasn't constant, and he failed to keep up with his education. So he then, as I say, went and decided to learn a trade. One which he states had an ease with and a natural talent, and that was to be a joiner or a square wright and work with wood. And basically a square wright is a highly skilled carpenter or joiner. And indeed Alexander, who's very religious, describes this as his calling, as dictated by divine providence, which might sound a bit strange to us today in a more secular world, but you have to remember that they believed back then that, you know, the world was created and ordered by God, and everything and everybody had its purpose and place. So he very much believes that this trade is his calling as a joiner or square wright, and he's called to this by divine providence, by God, in that sense. So everything was divinely ordered and ordained as far as he was concerned.
What kind of person was Alexander Smith, and what social circles did he move in?
It's clear from the diary that Alexander Smith was a very religious and hard-working man. He'd started his work as an apprentice in 1713, and by 1719 he'd already worked for notable figures in Fraserburgh, such as Alexander Robertson, who was one of the leading town councillors or baileys, and also had worked for leading merchants in the city like James Greig and the town's minister, Mr. Auchinleck. And in 1720, he was employed by Mr. Dick to assist him in the work on Duff's properties in Banff. Now, the Duff family were a major, major landed family in the area in Banffshire. And of course, for him to get this contract to work for the Duff family would have been something very, very special indeed. So he was getting a reputation for himself as a good worker, as a good employee, as somebody who's very good at his trade. And this is important to remember that when we come to the 45, because it's very unfair what actually happens to this man. He's doing really, really well, and he manages to build up a good, solid, long-lasting social networks and relationships with the people around him and his employees, so he does really, really well.
So I imagine his life was significantly affected by both Jacobite risings in the 15 and the rising in 45. What impact did the 15 have on his early career?
The 1715 did have a significant impact on his early career, as he recalls. And so I took a trial at the rights trade and continued all that year, and the troubles began in Scotland, being concerning that rebellion upon which shortly that engagement did follow, which at Sheriff Muir being on November 13th, 1715. Of course, Sheriff Muir is the big battle of 1715, in which he goes on to say, at which all time business did cease almost, and came home at that winter and spring to my father's house, and did as I could some small things in my trade. So what if effectively he's saying is that the 1715 had a significant economic impact on his local area. His training ceased completely and he had problems finding work. Alexander Smith did the best he could under the circumstances. However, he confesses that this was all to do with the generosity of his father, who had allowed him to move back home. As you can imagine, this would have been a blow for Alexander Smith because he's been an independent adult. He's been in the world, he's built up his contacts for this business. Because of the 1715 rising, the networks and the social contacts in his early career just collapses to the point where his training ceases, his trade ceases, and he has to move back home. He has to move back home to live with his father. So in that sense, he's taken back quite a bit. But the impacts of the 1715 rising on his career should come as no surprise, because at the time, even though the 1715 had little bloodshed, at the time, armies from opposing sides marauded across the region, threatening each other, and then dispersed, plundering lands, property, and causing mayhem in the area. And perhaps the full threat of a full-scale war was just as bad as war itself, in the sense that why would you employ a tradesman to repair your house when obviously you've got two marauding armies hell-bent on destroying property? There's just no point. So that in essence explains why his trade collapsed. So although this may seem like a small episode, this is very much a taster of what was to come with the 45. And as we'll see later, the 45 had an even more devastating impact on his life.
Between 1717 and 1744, his life, like many of his contemporaries, had its ups and downs, but he became a very successful businessman. Can you tell us more about this part of his life?
It wasn't until 1717 that his business started picking up for Alexander Smith. So that's 2 years after the rebellion. So it's not until 2 years after the rebellion that his business starts picking up, which again is sort of, you know, amplifies the fact that the 15 was quite significant on his early career. And even during 1717, through odd jobs that Alexander had done, he becomes well known in Fraserburgh and is asked to work with another tradesman, Robert Allen, on the Bailey, who is of course councillor in the city, his house. After which he'd worked for this Bailey, whose name was Alexander Robertson, the customers increased, and he began to build a good reputation for himself, leading to his employment again at the Duff's properties in Banff, and of course the Duff family were the major family in the area. Despite this, Alexander Smith keenly remembers how the 1715 rebellion almost put a stop to his career. Between 1715 and 1745, business boomed for Alexander Smith and his network of customers increased, and mainly this was due to word of mouth. He continued to cultivate a good reputation for his work and his own conduct. In addition, there were very few tradesmen in the local area which could compete with his skills, so he was very lucky indeed. Significantly, the solid business networks, especially amongst the landed elite, were based on existing social networks, so they're all linked. And it's also clear that this was a period of relative financial stability, where there were no restrictions on the surrounding financial transactions. Now, this is very important to remember when we get to the 45, because the 45 has a devastating impact on people's financial transactions. Not something that you would immediately think about with the 45. Most people think about battles and war and people fighting, but for people's ordinary life, it actually had a significant impact on financial transactions. However, during this period, it's obvious and it's clear that it was very stable financially. And in order to fully appreciate the impact of the 1745 on the rebellion of the 1745 rebellion on the world of Alexander Smith, we have to explore his business, his career, and his life before the 45 took place. It is notable that Alexander Smith was a highly motivated person. In 1718, he'd contemplated moving to Edinburgh to pursue his trade, but he received plenty of work in Fraserburgh and the surrounding area, so he abandoned the plan and remained at home. In October 1719, he got married to Margaret Keith, and a few days later, he was called upon to do some work for the Forbes family of Boyne Lee. And the Forbes family of Boyne Lee were another major family in the area. So he's doing pretty well. He's linking himself with all the major landed families in the area. He found the Laird of the Laird of Boyne Lee was a very kindly man, a very devout and religious man who obviously saw potential in Alexander Smith. He actually lent Smith books and had learned conversations with him. And this what this highlights is that, you know, it's not like Downton Abbey where you've got an upstairs or downstairs. That, you know, in some cases there were situations when those higher up the social standing would help those below the social standing in that sense. And in this case, the Laird of Boyne Lee gave Alexander Smith books, helped him learn, helped him get an interest in reading and things. Smith also received excellent wages, and he felt that Boyne Lee treated him like a friend. Smith freely acknowledges that Boyne Lee spoke to others about his excellent work, so his reputation continues to grow. And after this, Smith continues to do odd jobs until March 1720, when he's employed to work again on the Duff properties in Banff. So as you can see, the same major families, the same contacts, keep on coming back, so you can see his business growing and snowing, becoming something really, really good. He felt that he was very fortunate that he was in these networks, and he had a good period of training, and he had excellent wages for what was a journeyman in the north, as he called himself, a man who went from job to job to job to try and survive. And he was surviving pretty well. In the following year, in 1721, Smith was again employed by Mr. Auchinleck, the minister of Fraserburgh and the Laird of Boyne Lee. So these contacts keep coming back. In this year of 1721, though, despite his professional life doing very, very well, tragedy struck him personally when he lost his wife through childbirth, and he lost two other infants that year. He acknowledges that his clients had actually become friends and actually had tried to help him through the grieving process. So again, this shows that maybe people of various social standings in times of crisis actually do support each other, which is very positive indeed. During this time, Smith's reputation grew, so despite what he was going through, his reputation continued to grow, and so did his number of employees. And remember, he's going through a period of crisis in his personal life. He's lost two children, he's lost his wife, but he's still doing pretty well. His business is going pretty well. And he then makes a contact called Mr. Shand, who becomes a good friend with. And he trades in wood with this Mr. Shand, and this Mr. Shand gets him really good wood from Holland and Danzig. Now, you might think that that's an incidental sort of fact, but actual fact, this is important when we come to the 45 and about what happens to trade in the local area during the 45 and what happens to men like Alexander Smith. So it's important to remember that in this time between the two rebellions, wood was easy to get. In fact, Scotland used to import wood from Holland and also Danzig, and trade was going pretty well. And things were so rosy and happy that, you know, he was given this wood, and if he wanted to delay payment for this wood, he could do so. There were no restrictions on financial transactions, so he was doing really well. And he recalls, "Thus the Lord in his good providence still provided friends and all things that he saw fit for me, and for which I desire to bless him that he cared so well for me, that was so unworthy of the least of his mercies." So he's grateful to God for the good fortune that he's had. And again, this language may seem pretty strange to us in a secular world, but in the world of Jamie Fraser, this is the sort of language that was commonplace. This is how people spoke, believing that God or had ordered the world as such. And that he, obviously, Alexander Smith at this point, felt that God was looking after him. So, but the good thing is, on the upside, in 1722, Alexander Smith actually falls in love again and he gets married. He gets married to Mary Buchan, who's the youngest of three daughters of Fraserburgh merchant John Buchan. So he keeps his social standing up. It is clear that Alexander Smith continued to have a good reputation in the town in this period, since most of the heads of the families in Fraserburgh were all very well entertained at his wedding. So all the heads of the major families in Fraserburgh, including the Frasers themselves, turned up to his wedding, and they had a good party. They had a good wedding reception. And after his wedding, he was called to work for a number of prominent people in the area. Again, Mr. Auchinleck, the minister, and others. It is clear at this time that Alexander Smith was highly enjoyed his work, and he believed that the kindness of his employers very much contributed to that enjoyment, which allowed his family to continue to live comfortably. And his business continues to grow, and his clients continue to grow. Again, added to his client list is the Laird of Kilravick, or Kilrake, who's a major landowner in the area, and also the Frasers of Philorth, who are the big landed family in the area, whom Fraserburgh is named after. He gets contracts with them as well. So he's doing really, really well. So much so that in 1740, he can actually have enough money to do up his own house. Believe it or not, he had to save up for about 15 years until he could do up his own house. So he joyfully records in 1740 that he actually has enough money that he can renovate his own house. And he's delighted. He says, "I'm getting tiles all the way from Aberdeen," which to us may sound a bit strange, but that he's delighted with this, and it highlights that he's done really well for himself, that he's earned this money that can allow him to afford to get tiles and good wood from very, very good sources. So he's done very, very well for himself. And it's clear after 1715 that Alexander Smith had built up a good close network of employers and friends, and was very well respected and highly thought of. Many of his employers had repeatedly called on his services for many years. He had amassed a reasonable income from virtually nothing. And this is something to remember, he'd amassed this income from virtually nothing. And clearly and understandably, he felt that God's providence was actually on his side.
Sadly, the 45 had a devastating impact on his business and his life, through no fault of his own, as he was a bystander to the main events. Now, what happened?
In 1745, with the onset of the Jacobite Rising, in the midst of the War of Succession, his fortunes were going to take a drastic turn for the worse. These events were to change his life for the rest of his days. And at the beginning of the year, Alexander Smith describes himself in the very throng of work. He clearly doesn't see any problems on the horizon. He gets employed to build a house for William Binney on the Green near the Kirk in Fraserburgh, and he sees no future financial problems. Indeed, Alexander Smith had been paid in advance to do the job, so that in itself shows you that the owner, who'd employed him to do the job had obviously realised or had thought that there would be no problems on the horizon. And during the spring, Alexander Smith was also asked to do some right work for the manse belonging to the Minister of Longmay. So his contacts are continuing to grow, business is booming, and he's going from strength to strength. However, at this point, during 1745, he is wrongly persuaded to get wood on the cheap. And this is sort of where it all goes wrong. Never get wood on the cheap. Never try and do anything illegal. It's always gonna come back on you. But this is what he does. He tries to get wood on the cheap. He does this fearing that he's going to lose work to a competing mason. So he feels under pressure by his competitors. So Smith had bought most of the material for this build, for this manse in Longmay, on the cheap, and he was forced to lower his prices. And this was a very bad decision, because soon after, the rising begins. And he states, "And being in the time of war, wood grew very dear, and the unhappy rebellion broke out that year. Two of his apprentices actually fled to join the excitement, and he lost some members of his workforce," which is possibly an impact to 1745 that many people don't think about. But, some of his workmen thought, well, this sort of joinery business is very dull. I'm going to get a bit of excitement and join the rising. And that's what happens. His workforce gets diminished. In addition, whilst working, his team were actually threatened by Jacobite rebels, and they disrupted the progress of his work. He sort of notes them coming in and out of the neighbourhood, and every time they come in and out of the neighbourhood, they cause disruption. So his work slows down. His progress is slowed down with his work. And so in his own words, he states, "So by all this and more circumstances," and he's talking about the manse at Longmay, "that house turned out greatly to my loss, against my intentions, power or will." He's not blaming the disaster on the fact that he got cheap wood or he did anything naughty. He's saying that the 1745 rebellion had actually made sure that what he was doing turned out to be a loss for his business. And it was out with his circumstances, his own ability to control circumstances, and out with his own intentions, power or will. And so he feels, a religious man, that God is now starting to turn against him. And it's clear from reading his journal that wood was in very short supply at this time. What actually grew up was a black market for wood at this time, during the rebellion. And again, this is something, the significance of this diary is that it allows us to look at the economic impact, which is what historians don't really think about. But at this time, it shows that there was a black market for wood that grew up because wood became so expensive to have. And people were desperate for this wood and to continue in their trade in these difficult economic times. And they were taking advantage of any customers that they could and got wood from wherever they could get it. Alexander Smith had to go all the way to Lough Aber. And for your listeners who are maybe not familiar with Scotland, Lough Aber is on the west coast of Scotland. So he's literally got to walk to the other side or go to the other side of the country to get wood supplies. So he's travelling from the east coast of Scotland all the way to the west coast of Scotland to get wood supplies. Now you've got to bear in mind Scotland's in rebellion as well, so you've got marauding armies in his way, you've got disruption, dislocation, you've got, armies going back and forth. So there's a lot of disruption going on at the time, but he has to go all the way to the west coast of Scotland to get his supplies. Also as well, he notes that he also has to go to Garmouth, which is not that far from Fraser Bar. It's about an hour away, but it's still a long way away during 1745 to get wood supplies. And then when he's on his way back, he meets two boatmen at a place called Gamry, which is not far from Fraserburgh. But they actually cheated him. They actually conned him into buying wood in that sense at a very high price. So what you can see from a local level is that when the 45 was going on, the economy just turned into chaos. In that sense, people were cheating other people were undercutting other people, supplies for wood and for the trade were short, and you know, it was dissolving into economic chaos. His debt was getting gradually bigger and bigger, and he made a huge loss on the manse at Longmay, and in addition struggling to build other houses that he'd committed to. But he tried keeping men working on as long as he could. And in his desperation to get wood, he did something equally very very naughty. He actually bought oak off a clerk for £120 for a recent shipwreck off the coast in December 1745. Now, that effectively is stealing, because the shipwreck, he doesn't own that wood. But he was offered this wood by a clerk who was in the area near the shipwreck. He'd offered to sell Alexander Smith this wood for £120. And if this is a measure of his desperation to get some wood to carry on with his trade, that he effectively resorts to taking it from a shipwreck, which under Scots law is actually stealing. And as it happens, the wood was not Ritchie's to sell, and as a result it was sold without the owner's permission. So again, what this diary tells us is that people are all clambering over each other to survive during the 1745 rebellion, and they're sort of undercutting each other. They're selling things that they shouldn't sell. There's a lot of criminal economic activity going on at the time. And so he ended up in trouble, and he ended up in court, and he ended up having to raise funds and force his clients to pay him. And he got himself into a state of bother. But what he suggests about this is that he confesses towards the end of his account of the 45 that the rebellion had just amplified his existing problems. Remember that he took wood on the cheap, and then he undercut his prices. But then when Scotland went into a form of, or particularly in this area, it went into a form of economic chaos, economic meltdown, it amplified his problems in that sense. So he ended up in serious debt, and he was forced to borrow more money. And although historians should never really ask what if, and deal with the facts, one wonders if business had carried on as usual without the interruption of the rebellion, if Smith would have managed to pay off his debts. It's because of the rebellion his debts just climb and climb and climb. And it is clear that the 1745 had an impact on his career on the long term. Because in 1746, after the rebellion has ended, Alexander Smith tried the best he could to get by. But he could never escape the cycle of debt, even though he worked very hard. But all his money was going towards the repayment of debt, rather than subsistence for living, and money was just flowing through his hands due to the doubling and tripling of interest by his creditors. So he couldn't get out of this debt. And it was such a bad state of affairs that he was often working for nothing. And in In 1747, he got a call to work at one of the major Hanoverian forts, Fort Augustus, to inspect some work there. So obviously, to a certain degree, his reputation was intact. He hadn't been tarred with the Jacobite cause, but it took him so long to respond, and he lost the potential contract, and he was never contacted again. In 1748, business began to pick up again, and he worked for several gentlemen in the area. But in reality, after the 1745 rising, he never ever could clear his debt, and the 1745 rising was going to haunt him for the rest of his days.
So with the background of the two risings and the story of Alexander Smith, what in particular has caused you to want to share the story with us today?
It's just a reminder that although people like Bonnie Prince Charlie and the Duke of Cumberland are very interesting figures in their own right, that, to be honest, the ordinary people of this world, say the sort of Jamie and Claire Frasers of the world, their story is just as much more equally as important as the likes of Bonnie Prince Charlie and the Duke of Cumberland. So, effectively, as I say, the fact that people were going about in their ordinary daily life and innocently caught up through war, through no fault of their own, is something that we should never really forget, despite the romanticism or the dominance of Bonnie Prince Charlie and the Duke of Cumberland during the period.
Well, this has been fascinating to learn about the life of a, for all intents and purposes, ordinary person who did not actively participate in, but who was absolutely in and around and affected by the uprisings. And to, as you said, it is very important to keep in mind, or it's very easy when you look at a time period or look at a war or look at some kind of, I don't want to say high point, but some huge part of any country's history, and you read about this huge fight or this huge rebellion. It's really easy, and books are typically written by or for, or highlighting at least, the both sides, but talking about the major players. And that's, I think, echoes what you were saying, is it's great to learn about those things, and it can be highly romanticized, and they may not even be made to be bigger than they are. But when all you see are the quote unquote two sides, or the two or three or four, however many large figures who are known in history, it's very easy to forget that there were people who weren't even maybe fighting on the battlefields that had to run their everyday lives. And you can see in the example of Alexander Smith, a perfect illustration of someone who was just doing his best to make ends meet and to raise a family.
Indeed. And, dare I say, and drawing comparisons with today, but you can see this all over the world, you know, wars all over the world. When you watch the news, you see the impact it has on ordinary people's lives. And as I say, I think it's something that we should never forget, is that these individuals are just as important as the big players in these circumstances.
Absolutely. Now, as we wind or close up, is there anything else that you wanted to share regarding Alex Smith or regarding your research or some upcoming projects that you'll be working on?
Well, I'm hoping to work on a project which does look at the impact the Jacobite rebellions had on ordinary people. I'm guessing that there are more people out there like Alexander Smith who had their lives deeply affected by the Jacobite risings. In fact, I am actually descended from a couple of Jacobites whose lives, some of them were active participants in the risings, some of them weren't. And what I find fascinating is the impact that it had on these families. Particularly during the 45, you had a situation whereby if you'd risen for the 15, but you hadn't risen for the 45, the Hanoverians would still suspect you as having sympathies for the Jacobite cause, and that in itself could have been quite serious. So in my case, I have ancestors who had land in Glenlivet and had actually built a Catholic seminary on that land. They built a sort of Jesuit college on that land, and they were active Jacobites. And although they didn't rise for the 45, they had their lands confiscated. And the seminary was actually destroyed by Cumberland soldiers. They came, burnt it down. So what I would like to do is explore what happened to, you know, ordinary people who maybe didn't actively participate in the risings, or just basically ordinary people who did. What happened to them? What impact did it have on their lives? And I think it would be fascinating to find all these various stories. I'm sure that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of interesting stories and stories to tell about various individuals who got caught up in the risings and the impact that it had on them, from all social classes, from all backgrounds. So it's something I'm really keen to explore further.
Well, that sounds fascinating because, as you said, we hear all about the Cumberlands, and we hear all about the Bonnie Prince Charlies and their lieutenants and their commanders and all of that. But it's the everyday person that really took, you know, participatory or not, that really took the brunt. And it is fascinating just to see how people did their best, succeeded or not, to cope with events that were maybe even out of their hands.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it also shows the resilience of the human spirit as well. You know, in these times of war, what people can go through and how they can try to survive, or if they do survive or not. And I think, you know, besides Alexander Smith, there's going to be a lot of stories that are sad, but ones that are actually very, very happy. And I think that would be fascinating in itself, to see how the human spirit responds to circumstances like this and how it evolves.
Well, we look forward, if you would consider us as your research continues. We would love to be able to hear more about some of the everyday people and that resiliency of the human spirit as your research continues. That would be amazing to hear more such stories.
Thank you very much for having me today.
Well, thank you. It's been our pleasure. Thank you so much.
Many thanks to Dr. Kirstine McKenzie for speaking with us. And thank you, dear listener, as always, for joining us. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @outlanderpod. That my own